Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hey, folks, welcome to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we have Ronnie Coleman, who's a retired state fire marshal for the state of California and chairman of the California State Firefighters Association Volunteer Committee. And they're talking to us remotely. I'm in the studio with the engineer, and Mike and Ronnie are down south. Hey, you guys.
Well, hello, Ted and Richard. I hope everything's going well up in Santa Barbara. We're coming live to you today from the Sheraton Park Hotel in Anaheim, just across the street from Disneyland. And I'd like to welcome Chief Coleman to the show today.
Glad to be here. Thanks a lot for the invitation.
Well, a couple of quick announcements here. The Elder Dependent Adult Abuse Prevention Council is hosting on October 11th, 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., Elder and Dependent Abuse Prevention Seminar. Again, this is October 11th, 2012, 9 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at the Elwin Muscle Senior Center, 510 East Park Street in Santa Barbara. Excuse me, that'll be in Santa Maria. For further information, 925-9554, 925-9554, sponsored by the Area Aging Agency on Aging, the Goleta Valley Chamber Center, Marion Medical Center, Alzheimer's Association, and the City of Santa Maria. Caltrans would like to remember and remind folks that Caltrans, California Highway Patrol, and construction industry contractors are calling for the California for their help in the ongoing effort to make highway work zones safer. Merge to the left as you see the crews on the side of the road. This is very important. And finally, from the California Highway Patrol, Santa Barbara County, Don't Drink and Drive, Arrive Alive. This is the U.S. 101 and 154 DUI traffic safety corridor. That's coming to a close. For further information on this project, California Highway Patrol, 967-1234, 967-1234. Community Alert brought to you by the California Fire Safe Council. Chief, thank you for taking time out to visit with us today. We're going to talk about the National Fire Heritage Center. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, as you know, and most people who are interested in the fire service know, firefighters like to collect things. You visit a firefighter's home, it's not uncommon to find things hanging on the walls of the tools of the trade, a fireman's axe, a fireman's helmet, whatever. That often results in a lot of these artifacts ultimately ending up in a museum. Sometimes individual fire departments take an old fire station and convert it into a local museum. Then we have state museums, and we got regional museums and so forth. Our organization is slightly different than all of that. We call ourselves the National Fire Heritage Center, and our motto is we are preserving the perishable. What we're after is collecting the lives of and experiences of firefighters, people who spent an entire career. Maybe they didn't die on the line of duty, because we recognize all of our firefighters who do die on the line of duty, but what about that 100-year-old gentleman down the street who was a volunteer firefighter in 1931. That's what the National Fire Heritage Center is all about, is remembering those people.
Now, you're the founder of the Heritage Center. What inspired you to do this?
Well, I don't consider myself to be the founder. I consider myself to be the person currently involved in the stewardship of it. The real true founder of this concept was a fellow named Dr. Harry Hickey. Dr. Hickey is a fire protection engineer, well known for his contributions to the fire science field in the fire service. He started raising questions probably 20 years ago. There was a report written by the federal government saying this is something that's really a good idea, but the federal government can't do it. So we formed a committee. Almost all of the people that formed the original committee are still pretty heavily involved in the organization itself. We created a 501c3 and went to work on developing the Heritage Center.
Now, one of the interesting things is where the Heritage Center is located. How did you pick that location?
Well, there's two reasons. One was we had a basic idea. We wanted to have our organizational site somewhere near the National Fire Academy, which is located in Emmitsburg, Maryland. It just so happened that there was a relationship with a local firemen's association from Frederick County, and a guy who, the county individual who worked with that, a fellow named Chip Buell, and it was just fortuitous that we were able to kind of work together with the Firemen's Association and the locals to put our initial facility into a building that used to house an ambulance company. It's literally across the street and down the block from the National Fire Academy, easily within walking distance.
So you get, it's open to the public. Folks can come in off the street and participate in what you have there on display.
Well, it's like any other museum. We have operating hours. Sometimes they're open because we got a volunteer who's willing to open the front doors. There's other days when we don't have a regular calendar event yet, but we do have people come visit from the National Fire Academy all the time. We have an annual meeting in October of every year with the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation, and there are thousands of people who come to that event. We keep our museum open during those days so they can wander in and out. What you would see in our place is slightly different than some other museums in that we focus on the accomplishment of individuals, their personal libraries, their personal written papers, their personal contributions.
Well, one of the things that I've taken kind of an interest in is doing research. As you know, you and I have been doing a lot of research on a variety of things. And there's a plethora of information out there on the Internet, but it isn't necessarily all cataloged in any one place where you can actually sit down, grab the actual document. It's one thing to have it on the Internet, but to have the actual document, that's a big thing. I like to spread stuff out and look back and forth. And you can't really do that on the Internet unless you have multiple screens. You're attempting to create that kind of facility.
Well, eventually, not today, but eventually we're hoping to have a lot of this stuff available as electronic files. And you're right when you say that we're looking for originals. We're looking for the original sprinkler ordnance, the original smoke detector design, the original steamer, you know, et cetera. What we're after is, we call them legacy documents. Legacy documents are ones that are so important you can't afford to let them disappear.
Where are you finding a lot of these documents? In reality, as you reach out across the country trying to find them, or actually across the globe for that matter, where do you find most of this stuff is being housed today?
Well, you ever watch that TV show about the Pickers, the American Pickers?
Yes.
That's like me and about 1,000 of my buddies. We're always out prowling through things. We get phone calls from the survivors of key fire service individuals. It's not uncommon for me to get a phone call from a daughter, a granddaughter, or even a great-granddaughter, and say, you know, Pop passed away recently, and we got all this stuff, and we don't have any idea what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start working with them. We have a lot of alliances with local fire museums, and we're not interested in collecting fire trucks and heavy-duty hardware and stuff like that. So we often help settle the arrangement so that the heir, the person who's got to deal with it, can give us the kind of things that make a difference to the intellectual side, and we help them find someplace else to put the rest of the stuff. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a partnership.
If you've collected some of this stuff, what are some of your prizes right now that you guys have been able to find, locate, and save, preserve?
When you say prizes, that's a matter of value judgment as to who thinks that's a prize. But I will. I would suggest that the kind of things that we've got right now, we have one of the logbooks of an engine company that was on 911. For a short while, had an opportunity to review the actual logbook of the firefighters who fought Pearl Harbor in the field. I have several first edition books that have come from clear out of the 1880s, 1850s, 1840s that we're beginning. When it says the prize, you almost have to poll my board to see which one they think is the most important.
What are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of the fact that I've been able to collect an awful lot of the original documentation of fire training and education. I did my master's thesis on the evolution of fire training, and so I've gone back and looked in the work of Ralph J. Scott, the work of Sir Ira Massey Shaw, the London Fire Brigade, people like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're coming up to our first break here. We're visiting today with former State Fire Marshal Chief Ronnie Coleman. We're talking about the National Fire Heritage Center. Their website is nationalfireheritagecenter.org. That's nationalfireheritagecenter.org. Coming to you live today from the California State Firefighters Association Annual Conference, Sheraton Park Hotel in Anaheim, California. FireSafe Council is our primary sponsor. Community Alert, not if but when. Positive preparation for disaster on KTSB AM 1290 or Santa Barbara News Press Radio, and live on the Internet today at newspress.com.
Hey,
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with Chief Ronnie Coleman, who's a retired California State Fire Marshal, and he's the president of the National Fire Heritage Center. And we're talking a bit about that. And Chief Coleman is also involved in the fire services all over the country and almost internationally. So he's got lots of titles and things. But great to have you with us, Chief. And Mike, what's up?
Well, I'd like to get an updated website out. I gave the old website out unintentionally. The correct website is thefhc.org. Thenfhc.org. So, Chief, let's get back to one of the things that I'm fascinated in is what you guys have done with going back and starting off with Benjamin Franklin and giving an award and recognizing him as a kind of the cornerstone or the starting point of the American Fire Service as we think of it today. Also, the start of the mail, a start of our insurance industry. I mean, he started a lot of things, and it all actually interrelates very nicely. Tell us a little bit about Benjamin Franklin. I know you have a passion for him.
Yes, I do. He's one of my favorite subjects. I've traveled rather extensively looking into things he did or didn't do, as the case may be. Benjamin was born in January of 1706. And ran away from home as a very young person to become a printer. And in fact, it's interesting, if you go to his gravesite, it doesn't say fire chief on his gravesite. It says Benjamin Franklin Printer. That's what it says right on the stone itself.
Interesting.
He was very enthusiastic about community service, period. He is credited with creating the first kind of organized fire department. There were fire departments in existence before 1736 in the colonies, but they sort of lacked this concept of being organized and structured and et cetera. Benjamin Franklin was an incredibly interesting individual in that he was not only a very practical person, but he was an intellectual. And he did things ranging all the way from his experiments with electricity to describing the Gulf Current and, of course, heavily involved in the American Revolution. We tend to regard him as being kind of like the patron of the American Fire Service because of that 1736 creation of that fire department in Philadelphia.
Did he make it up as he went, or did he have some models that he used as a guideline?
Well, there were actual models for him to look at prior to that. There's clearly evidence in the early colonial days that when the people come from the different countries, England, Germany, and France primarily, and some to a certain degree Scandinavia, when they came to the United States, almost all of them brought together European firefighting practices, the whole idea of community involvement, the bucket brigade, the fire insurance marks. We didn't invent fire insurance in this country. All we did was copy what they were doing in England. So Franklin was, like I said, a very pragmatic kind of guy who would always look at a concept and say, well, how can I make that work for me, you know? And then he'd get the community to do it.
Well, how much resistance did he have back in those days? Because things were a lot different then. And he's suggesting that as a community, we need to protect our mutual assets, whether they're stores, our businesses, our homes, and what have you. How much resistance did he meet to that?
Well, he obviously met a great deal of resistance over time. If you read his life story, his biography, and his autobiography, you'll find that he was in conflict with a lot of people throughout most of his life, especially his adversaries in the printing field, his political adversaries. But you also have to read all of his so-called Poor Richard Almanac sayings to realize that none of that stuff really bothered him too much. I always felt that if I ever had a chance to sit down at the dining room table with Benjamin Franklin, we'd end up in an argument.
Well, he was a very prolific writer, and certainly a lot of this stuff transcended over each other, and he was able to bring some of other traditions and values into the fire service because he set a lot of the standards that are still in effect applicable today.
Well, what he was primarily involved in doing was kind of setting the philosophical aspects of the volunteer fire service, of the idea of doing it based on community need. What prompted him, by the way, in 1736 was a burning of a ship and a warehouse in a berth in Philadelphia that destroyed a lot of commerce. And he wasn't so much altruistic as he was economic. He said, we can't afford that. We got to do something about it.
Well, how successful was he in working as he developed the insurance industry? And the insurance industry quickly started to grow, which was an issue in and of itself, because I think insurance was kind of contrary to what some people thought was reasonable at the time. How did that all evolve?
Well, that's a very complicated story in and of itself. There's a wonderful book out on it about the history of fire marks. INA, I think, was the publisher of it. And if you looked at the early days of the insurance industry, they would work collectively with groups of people to represent their community interest. And that's why the fire mark was put on the outside of the building, because it had to be your crew that was going to go in and take the bed apart. Believe it or not, one of the most important pieces of furniture in colonial America was the bed. They had what they called bed keys, and these people carried salvage bags and bed keys. They would rush to the scene. Sometimes they wouldn't even fight the fire. They just try to get all the property out of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you speak of fighting the fire. There was also the firemen fighting each other back in those days.
Oh, yes. A little physical altercation has occurred frequently, and up to and including the beginning of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
There were riots in which firefighters were involved in physical riots.
Well, it was a contact sport in more ways than one. It's interesting that the fire service took a bit of a turn after the Civil War because the fire service began to adopt some of the military ways of doing things.
Well, a lot of that emerged in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
One of the stories I like to recant, rediscuss, not recant, is the death of Colonel Elmer Ellsworth. He was a commander of an infantry regiment that consisted of entirely volunteer firefighters out of New York. He was the first combat casualty of the Civil War. He was killed in Fairfax, Virginia, trying to take down a Confederate flag off the top of a bar. And it led to a battle cry called Remember Ellsworth. There was a group called the Fire Zouaves, which led, in many cases, when the firemen came back from the Civil War, the cities had grown so much that they needed full-time firemen. And so a lot of the early firefighters in most, especially urban communities, looked like retired Civil War soldiers. They wore blue uniforms. They had gold badges, you know, that kind of thing.
And that really hasn't changed all that much,
over
the decade. There's an appearance difference of sorts between East Coast firefighters and West Coast firefighters, but that's true of law enforcement and pretty much everything. But one of the other things that's kind of interesting during this period of time was the invention of the fire steamer, which you also have a passion for. But what was the real reason that they came out with mechanical fire apparatus? This is kind of interesting.
Well, the real reason that the steamer finally got adopted was a riot in Cincinnati. They had a fire, and all the volunteer fire companies pulling hand-pulled apparatus pulled up the scene, and they got into this physical altercation and started wailing on each other. They used to have a term, by the way, called plug uglies. And what a plug ugly was a member of the volunteer fire department who would run ahead of everybody else and then cover the hydrant up so your opposing units could not get access to it. So the steamer came about. It was being developed by about that time for railroad application.
Mm-hmm.
And making steam was, by the way, not necessarily a new technology by any stretch. That had been done for 2,000 years. But the industrial age led to the industrialization of that steam.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. So, but it's interesting to me that the mechanicalization of the fire service really had nothing to do with a better distribution of water or suppression efforts or expediting equipment, or it had to do with personalities and the conflicts, which in some ways hasn't changed all the way to today.
Well, as a matter of fact, they had a contest between a hand pumper and a steamer, and the steamer beat the hand pumper, and the volunteers quit.
Well, I recall a presentation that you gave at the Allen Hancock 100th Graduation Academy, and out front was the CSFA live steamer with Dave and Barbara Hubert, and next to it was a Santa Maria KME brand-new off-the-shelf engine. And what's the difference between the two?
Not much.
Not much.
One's pulled by three horses, and the other one's pulled by a couple of hundred horsepower. But the actual pump capacity of a steamer and a modern pumper are not that much different.
And the demand for the amount of water hasn't changed much either, despite all the technology that's come down since. Visiting today with former State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman talking about the Heritage Foundation on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster on KTSB AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio, live from Anaheim, California. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams, coming to us today from down in San Diego. Is it San Diego County? No.
We're up in Anaheim.
Anaheim.
Right around the corner from Disneyland.
Oh, okay. And he's visiting with Chief Ronnie Coleman, who's a retired California State Fire Marshal and also the chairman of the California State Firefighters Association Volunteer Committee. And also, and more germane to what we're talking about today, he's the president of the National Fire Heritage Center. And Ronnie, I'm just going to ask you to kind of illuminate a little bit about steam pumpers and how they operate. And obviously, they don't put out hot water, but if you could just talk to us a little bit about that, I think that'd be good for the listeners.
Sure. I'll give you a little bit of a history lesson about steam power itself. Steam power was created by Hero of Alexander in Egypt over several thousand years ago. And the way that a steam unit works is that you take a heating mechanism, such as a fire, coal fire generally, and you have it in a pan at the bottom of this mechanism, and then you have a boiler above it that contains water. And as the water goes into that boiler, it's converted at a pretty rapid rate from liquid to a steam, which the expansion ratio is about 1 to 8,000. In other words, you take a teaspoonful of water, it's 8,000 teaspoons of steam. Then that steam is then forced into a set of pipes, and these pipes then go to drive impellers to turn a pump. And then that pump, as those impellers are spinning, then picks up the water from draft or from some form of positive pressure, and it puts out the water. It doesn't put out any hot water at all. The water is the temperature. It comes out of the ground or whatever its source is. The steam is vented. It's obviously a very dangerous operation, because if you build the steam up too fast and you're not paying attention to it, you can cause ruptures. In fact, there were many steamers exploded in service and killed people back in the early days. That sort of phenomena doesn't happen very much anymore, but what you've got is you got fire in the pan, water in the tubes, steam in the boiler, and then the pumps turn and project the water.
So we got a steam-powered pumping system as well.
That's correct. Great. The pump, of course, is pretty much the same then as it is today. They're just more robust today.
Actually, I always joke about it, because I had this line I use in one of my presentations about how much better is your fire truck out there in front from the one that's sitting in our museum. And they say, well, you know, that's an antique, it's a piece of junk, you know, nobody uses that stuff anymore. And I said, well, okay, let's look at the plate on the side of the steamer. It pumps 1,250 GPM at 150 PSI at a 10-foot draft. What does it say on the plaque on your truck? And it says the same thing.
Pretty much the same thing. You know what's interesting is that there was a lot of resistance to get away from steamers. When gasoline and diesel vehicles started to appear, they didn't want to get rid of the steamers.
Well, as a matter of fact, there's actually stories are told of firefighters who left the service rather than learn to drive a truck. They are using horses to pull steamers, obviously, and there's... If you've ever ridden in the front seat of a steamer at a full gallop on a brick road, you'll never have that experience anywhere else in the world. I will guarantee that. Because between the horses, the thudding of those hooves and the grumbling of the wheel and et cetera, it's a physically demanding type of thing. But the point of it is that every time you change technology, when we put the horses on the front of the apparatus, there was an entire generation. Most people don't remember this, but the steamers were only in service about 50 years. They started in the 1860s, and they started going out about 1910, 1920. Mm-hmm. Firefighters lived their whole career with horses. One of my favorite stories is Ralph J. Scott with the L.A. City Fire Department. When they retired his horses, he took them home and put them in his backyard.
Well, that's the birth of the fire station.
That's
because they needed a place to keep the steamers, because they actually had to keep a fire going inside the steamer at all times. You also need a place to house the horses.
That's right.
Thus, the birth of the fire station. Today, we don't have any of that.
Well, and they took the horses off and put motorized apparatus on the front. First of those were like the Christie front mounts, and some of the early engines were very unreliable. I mean, I've read comments by firefighters from that era, like, you never had a trouble starting a horse.
Well, the horses knew what to do, too.
Right.
It's kind of interesting. But moving back towards Benjamin Franklin, he was also a prolific writer, and he wanted to speak on that.
Well, yes. Matter of fact, I would like to mention that the National Fire Heritage Center wants to encourage writing, and we want to encourage archiving work. And we have several major projects we're engaged in right now I'd like to mention. The first one is called the Hall of Legends, Legacies, and Leaders. Every year we nominate someone out of the past to have their picture placed in a memorial at our facility for their contributions to the fire service. This is not about fire departments. It's about individuals. It's about the guys that and the gals in many cases that made significant contributions. We nominate about 10 people every year. Over a period of 100 years, we'll probably get around to a whole lot of folks. But this is only, I think, our third year doing it. That program is run by our Vice President, Bill Killen. Then we have another program that is referred to as the Ben Franklin Writers Award. We're trying to encourage people who do original writing. I'm not borrowing somebody's photocopy or I don't care, right, stuff like that. It's got to be original writing. We're trying to start recognizing those people. We've got a Writers Award program that we just initiated. This is our first year. Next year will be our second year. It's not as widely publicized as we'd like it to be. But we're interested if anybody out there has written something, newspaper article, magazine article, textbook, fiction book, whatever. We don't care what kind of writing format it is. What we're trying to do is emulate Franklin's behavior of if you think it, write it. If you write it, you can remember it.
Well, it's documentation, and I know with everything that I've been working on, I really have appreciated being able to go in and look at people's working notes, or going through your library up in Sacramento was a tremendous opportunity, because those are things that didn't mean anything necessarily other than perhaps a correspondence between various regulatory bodies that 30 years later suddenly became important. I was talking to a chief here yesterday at the conference about how I'd come across some of his documents that were probably 35, 40 years old. He kind of chuckled because nobody apparently read them then. I said, well, it doesn't matter. They're reading them now.
And I read them then.
Yeah.
I knew who you're talking about.
Yeah. But it's some of this stuff carries forward. And if we look at some of the issues we have today going on, they were forecasted 30, 40 years ago. These guys were not wrong when they said that, and yet they were chastised heavily for it.
Well, one of my favorite speeches I took out of a manual, and I read it at columns, at conferences, and I read this column, and I say, who said this? And I'll tell you what it's all about. It says that when you operate at the scene of a fire, one person's got to be in charge. That one person has to use appropriate management principles to divide up the labor so that the labor is following a chain of command and span of control. Hold it on. I read that whole thing, and I get done, and I say, okay, guys, who said that? Well, I'm not going to mention names on the radio station, but I'd be willing to bet you if there are firefighters out there, they could pop up with a bunch of names of who are the more popular lecturers in the American mm-hmm. Fire Service today. Well, after they list me about five or six people and we write them down, I point out to them that it was written in the training manual of the London Fire Brigade in 1871 by Captain Ira Massey Shaw, who was a military officer who was told by the Queen, organize the London Fire Establishment. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying basically is we think we invented ICS in 1971. It was in existence 100 years before that.
Well, it's a basic form of any administrative management technique. Applying it to the specifics of the fire service or law enforcement or trial preparation, there's a lot of similarities to it in trial preparation.
Yeah.
Let's move forward to another individual that's also fascinating. He's certainly a little bit closer to our time, and that's James O'Page. An attorney and Los Angeles City Battalion Chief.
James O'Page was a giant among giants. He was probably more instrumental in the creation of the everything we do in EMS than any other single individual was. He subsequently became a publisher. He was a fire chief of several cities, et cetera, and he's passed away, unfortunately. But his contributions are exactly the kind of thing we're talking about. Some of the things Jim wrote about in the 70s when they created the L.A. County program, because he was there. Mm-hmm. He was an integral part of that. Him and a fellow named Fred Klein were both very instrumental in it.
Well, you guys single him out as being an honoree and somebody worthy of following. Why? How did you pick him?
Well, in the first place, we're trying to keep track of getting some of these people before they pass away.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, James's death was traumatic to a lot of us because it happened almost instantaneously. There was no run-up to the fact that we had a chance to talk to him, which leads to my another project I'll explain to you later called Oral History that we're working on. When he passed away, we wanted to make sure his memory didn't end up in a dumpster.
Well, with that, we're up to our next break, visiting today with former State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman, and we'll be back in just a minute. Community Alert brought to you by the California Fire Safe Council, not if, but when, positive preparation for disaster on KZSB, AM 1290, or Santa Barbara News Press Radio, and live today on the Internet at newspress.com. We'll be back after these messages.
Folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with Chief Ronnie Coleman. He's a retired California State Fire Marshal, very involved in the fire services in California nationwide and also internationally. So really glad to have him on the program. Today we're talking a great deal about the National Fire Heritage Center and the people that are involved and celebrated there. So, Mike?
Well, we're live today from the Sheraton Park Hotel at the Anaheim Resort, just across the street from Disneyland, the California State Firefighters Association annual convention. So we're remote, we're live. Richard, our engineer, had an interesting question during the break. All the heroes. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Benjamin Franklin, huge figure in American history in so many different areas. And then, of course, all these other wonderful, notable names that you've been talking about, Ronnie. But the firefighting was dangerous enough as it was, as you've already expressed, as far as the steamers. But were there individuals who maybe should have considered a different profession or were actually stayed in the fire service but were just a detriment?
Well, you realize I'm not going to name names.
Certainly not this
not in this session anyway. But the fire service is an interesting culture, and I use that word very advisedly because people who get into the fire service come from a particular brand of human being that's really kind of almost got a bizarre outlook on life. For example, when something blows up or burns up, everybody else is running one direction, and all the firefighters are going the other direction. See, you almost got a couple of screws loose to even be in this business. So when it comes to the idea that have there been screw-ups, well, of course there have been. There's been, like, I can actually tell you, we got a section in the library that's full of firefighter joke books. And in fact, one of my more interesting possessions, I recently got a chance to review a department that had a joke book internal to the department on for all the stunts they pulled on their probationary firefighters, most of which would get you a jail sentence today.
It's considered hazing.
It was considered hazing in those days too, but they got away with it. So when we talk about people who the good side, the bad side, and so forth, what I'd like to answer your question by saying is that we've had some people in the fire service that have led departments in negative directions that has resulted in damage to firefighters, damage to the property, and so forth. We've learned lessons from those people. But if there's any one thing this business has got, is a huge sense of humor. And we've collected a lot of that kind of information also.
Well, that's a good point. The sense of humor never stops. But, we talk about, you have a policy or a saying about how every policy has somebody's name attached to it. And
yep.
That's probably true outside of the fire service, too.
Yep.
You can think of that's the so-and-so policy. But moving backwards here, you also have a hall of legends, and certainly Benjamin Franklin and Page are included in that.
Yes.
But who are some of the other folks that you've got?
Well, we've got, this is called the Hall of Legends, Legacies, and Leaders. And there's people like John Damrell, Miles Julian. If I can look at the screen there, I can probably read them off to you there. What's the last one on that list?
Patrick Raymond. Charles Holloway.
We've gone to a great deal of effort to look for example, the first female fire chief, the first African-American fire chief, the first of everything. We chose John Damrell as one of our early people because what a lot of people don't know about John Damrell is he's the guy who forced the creation of building codes. He was a fire chief. He ended up as the chief building inspector for Philadelphia, and he made a huge inroad on getting codes read into statute and things of that nature. As I said, we do about 10 a year,
mm-hmm.
And some of them may look obscure to most people, but they're in there for the reason we found out that they did something very unique. For example, and I always think this is humorous, is that the first fire chief of L.A. City was a volunteer fire chief.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep that in context of that sprawling metropolitan today? Well, it started there.
Well, you look at a lot of the metropolitan fire department. New York, New York still has volunteer fire agencies within the greater New York fire department.
Oh, I always like to mention the fact that that's why they call themselves FDNY, because the fire department existed before the city did.
And that's interesting, because the fire service goes back that far.
Yes.
And of all the folks that you've put down here, who has done something that's probably the most instrumental that nobody really thinks about, they just take for granted today? I look at sprinklers, for example, residential and commercial sprinkler systems, kind of an innocuous thing to the untrained eye that you see them, but you don't think anything about them. There's an example. The fire extinguisher itself has a long history. Game well boxes and the alarm systems. There's a lot of things in the fire service that kind of went out. But what stands out is sort of a pivotal thing.
Well, you know, the pivotal thing in my lifetime was actually an event, not a person.
Okay.
It was America Burning. America Burning was a document that was sponsored as a result of some very serious fire loss statistics we're experiencing in the 70s. President Nixon put it together. Gerald Ford actually ended it. And it was as close as we could get to the work done by President Truman in 1947. President Truman held a national conference on fire loss. And if you take a look at the 47 report and then America Burning, a lot of what we've done in the fire service within the reasonable memory of most people in it today started with America Burning. The reason it did is that's where the fire reporting system came from. That's where the National Fire Academy came from. That's where the United States Fire Administration came from. All of those started with America Burning.
Well, I think people started taking the fire service a lot more seriously because of the consequences of when it doesn't work well. And so as a result, I think that was a pivotal report that got things going in a different direction.
Yeah.
You know, going back to Charles Miles, the first chief engineer of the city of Los Angeles, there's an interesting quote here. Unfortunately for him, he entered politics, a role in which he was surprisingly popular. He had every qualification for politics except one. He could not, for the life of him, say no. And I'm not sure that that's a trait that's changed too much, but you know, there's quite a few folks that have come from the fire service and entered into the political arena.
Well, one of the things we're trying to do with the legends and legacies and leaders is to document some of those activities and events, because quite frankly, I mean, I'm sure you're going to can relate to this from your own personal knowledge, sometimes we lose track of when something was done, but we take it for granted from that day forward. For example, I consider one of the most major watershed efforts in the American Fire Service was the creation of the smoke detector.
Because
when it first came out, they were very expensive, and it took a lot of guts for people to advocate and fight for them and all this other stuff.
You know, I know you have a serious passion for sprinkler systems. What's a little bit of the history of sprinklers, both residential and commercial? Because it goes back away also.
Oh, yeah. The concept of sprinkler protection actually started with the industrialization of America. The real reason sprinklers were put into shape, or put into position, rather, were to protect textile mills up in Massachusetts, because when they had fires in textile mills, they burnt quickly. The idea of residential sprinklers, believe it or not, was mentioned as early as 1910. We've had quite a renaissance in that particular arena over a period of about the last 40 years, starting with some work that I was associated with in San Clemente, California, and some other work that was done by other fire departments. Today, it's considered to be a very viable technology.
Has the sprinkler technology changed all that much over the years?
Literally, no. The concept of a fusible link and the water temperature and, excuse me, the air temperature and the activation and the piping systems, we've changed piping. We've changed components, but the system's pretty much the same.
It stays the same. Coming up to our next break, visiting today with California State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman on Community Alert. Visiting today for live from the Anaheim Resort across the street from the Disneyland facility at the California State Firefighters Association. Community Alert, not if but when, positive preparation for disaster on KZSB AM 1290 or Santa Barbara News Press Radio, live on the internet at newspress.com. Back in a moment. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, welcome to our last segment. This is Ted Adams, Community Alert. Mike Williams is down south in Anaheim with Chief Ronnie Coleman today. Chief Coleman is the president of National Fire Heritage Center, along with a lot of other things. He's been involved with Fire Service for many years. But today we've been talking primarily about the National Fire Heritage Center and his involvement and what it means to the public. Ronnie, you could talk to us a little bit about membership in the organization and how that's established and what that means to members.
Very good. We do have a membership scheme. Ranges all the way from a very minimal amount of a $25 membership participation. We've ranged our membership technique based on different levels of fundraising and different levels of involvement and so forth. So we have a brass level, a silver level, a gold level, a diamond level, and a platinum level. And any person with an interest in the fire service history or any interest in fire service insurance, fire protection engineering, almost anybody who has any interest at all in the legacies of the fire service, they can go on our website. We have a downloadable application. We do allow individuals to join the organization with the use of a credit card on the website. And what you get for that is a couple of things. One is we are constantly pumping information out through our website to our members. We also produce a newsletter four times a year that talks about archiving. For example, one of the major projects we're doing right now is oral history, where we're interviewing people who maybe didn't write down a whole bunch of things but have good memories. I'm interviewing a 101-year-old fire chief next week. And his career started, clear back in the early 1900s. And the membership that we're looking for right now is not restricted to just firefighters. We have authors, we have scientists, we have college teachers, we have students. Our membership is quite diverse.
Well, let me get the website out again. It's thenfhc.org, NHFC.org. Their telephone number, 888-819-4798, 888-819-4798. Their address, P.O. Box, Drawer 76, Emmitsburg. And, you know, we need to talk about Franklin briefly. Didn't he do something with glasses? Because I'm having a heck of a time reading.
He's credited with creating the bifocals, which I think you could probably use with that small screen, Mike.
You know, I got my bifocals, and I have to take them off because I can't read anything up close with my bifocals, and I'm trying to read off the screen these addresses and get the phone numbers out, and I can't see them. So, in any event, talking today here from the California State Firefighters Association's annual conference, and I know you've been a big supporter of CSFA, and this has been a tremendous event here. We had a California State Treasurer here just a couple hours ago. Great presentation there. A couple other folks coming in this afternoon. Chief Metro from LA County Fire was here yesterday talking about the EMS system and the things that are coming down the road. Any closing thoughts about what we're doing here today before we leave?
Well, I often remind everybody that there was a quote one time, I think it was from George Santa Anna, that said, if you can't remember the past, you're doomed to repeat it in the future. Mm-hmm. And one of our concepts as a heritage center is to preserve the perishable, preserve the memory, preserve the thought. It's not about hardware all the time. Sometimes it's about a person being committed and persistent and sticking to their guns and whatever the case may be. We would like as many people as possible who are retiring from the fire service to stay contacted with us so that we can make sure that their memory gets preserved.
Well, there's a lot of things in a lot of garages and in attics and underneath beds and what have you that may seem insignificant to most people, but that would be very valuable to you. How would they get a hold of you?
Best way to get a hold of me, obviously, is to go ahead and use my website because I get a lot of emails from other people. It's ron@fire, F-I-R-E, force, F-O-R-C-E, 1-O-N-E, .com. I usually respond very quickly to any emails to me. We have an executive director by the name of Wayne Powell, former NFA staff member, and we're pretty closely coordinated on following things up.
Well, very good. Let me get the phone number out for the organization also. This is National Fire Heritage Center at 888-819-4798, 888-819-4798, and the website one more time, thefhc.org. That's the NFHC.org. Well, thank you very much, Chief, for taking time out to be with us today. I appreciate that. I want to thank our sponsors, Cold Spring Tavern, Service Master Anytime, California State Firefighters Association, the Fire Services Training Institute, and State Farm Insurance in Santa Barbara. Ted, thank you very much.
Yeah,
Richard, on our engineer today.
Have a great day, you guys.
Very good. It's Community Alert, not if but when, positive preparation for disaster. On KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio, and live at the Internet at newspress.com. The news is next. Thank you for listening. See you next week.
This has been Community Alert, not if but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, and sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Technical support for Community Alert provided by Richard Dugan and Jim Williams. Community Alert, not if, but when, on KZSB AM 1290, your News Press radio station.